So to say a few points about the fourth Aliyah of Parshas Bamidbar. So it begins in a way where the language attracts a lot of comments. Rashi and other Mefarshim have different ways of understanding why the Aliyah begins with the language that it does, which is the aid that Be'ela told us Aaron and Moshe, V'yom Diber Hashem es Moshe v'Har Sinai. So here, these are the generations, or the offspring, probably is a better translation for Toldos, of Aaron. And we see that it's going to be the sons of Aaron who are named, but the language of the Pasuk is Aaron u'Moshe, v'yom diber Hashem. So why is Moshe included here? So the Gemara, Maseches Sanhedrin, on the Afya Testament base, notes that this is reflective of the idea that Kol HaMalamed as Ben Chaveru Torah Kilu Yolado. So Moshe, because he was the one who conveyed the Torah, who taught Torah to Aaron's sons, so it was Kilu, he's also a father. So Aaron was the biological father, and Moshe was the father in terms of giving them a complete spiritual identity.
It's going to segue into what Caleb just said before, because you're like, dude, 8 to 9 p.m., and he's like, oh, he has kids, but you're teaching us Torah.
Teaching Torah, exactly. So, that point, the Gemara elsewhere, in Sanhedrin also, and Daf Tzadites, the Gemara makes the same point from a maybe more well-known pasuk, and that's from Sefer Bereishis, and the reference to Avraham Avinu and HaNefesh Asher Asa B'charan. So he's credited, literally, or the words are literally, that he's making people. So how did he make those people? He made them by teaching them about God, teaching them the early version of Torah. So it's as if he actually made them. There are some who raise the question, so why does the Gemara need two psukim for this? It's probably not really a question, because neither one is being presented as the chiddush. Each one is using language that reflects that reality. So you can see from this pasuk or the other pasuk that seems to be the understanding, that to teach someone Torah is considered as if he has created them. So this is a notion that we have, that it's possible to be credited as a parent without actually being a biological parent. And this is without getting into the actual biological questions that are relevant nowadays because of surrogacy or donations, where there actually could be a question as to who is considered a biological parent. But moving out of biology completely, we see that spiritually it is possible for an individual to be credited as a parent, even though they're not actually the biological parent. And this is an idea that maybe we're even more familiar with in the context of adoption, that Chazal have the notion that Kol HaMagadel Yosom B'Sof Beso Kilo Yolado, that if somebody raises an orphan in his home, essentially adopts him, so then he's also credited as if he is the parent. So the question is, as a matter of practical halacha, just how far does that go? So what does that mean? So one would imagine there are all kinds of halachic implications, some more serious, some less serious, but just in a general sense, one would imagine that there should be a chiyuv of kavod towards a adoptive parent, and that seems to be true because of makoros such as this, but also because of the svara that is involved in kibud av v'aim. If you learn the Rishonim, who talk about the mitzvah of kibud av v'aim, so the theme of hakaras hatov is very front and center in terms of defining what that mitzvah is about. So if we assume that hakaras hatov is one of the active ingredients in kibud av v'aim, so it would seem that that should apply also to an adoptive parent. Certainly there should be hakaras hatov to an adoptive parent, and maybe even more hakaras hatov that it was completely voluntary. Somebody takes in a child who's not biologically their own, so maybe they do even more hakaras hatov. So that sounds intuitive, and there are many who assume like that. It's noteworthy that to hear a little synergy for those who are learning Daf Yomi. So Daf Yomi today started in the Masechta, which is synergy for us also, because the Masechta they started today was Gittin. So we will be overlapping with them for the next few weeks. But It finished yesterday, Masechet Sota. So the last daf in Masechet Sota, daf in Tes, there is a somewhat surprising Gemara. It's a little bit hard to understand what the message of that Gemara is, that it tells the story of someone who was a apparently an adoptive parent to his grandson. So he's got two things going for him. It was his daughter's son, and apparently he raised him. And nonetheless, the Gemara says that all he did later on was ask him for water. This was a Rav Acha bar Yaakov who took care of Rav Yaakov bar Barte, the son of his daughter, and later on he asked him for some water. And what was the Hakar Satov he gets? So the grandson says, Lav Brichano, I'm not your son. So, you know, it doesn't sound like the most grateful response. So clearly this Gemara, like other Gemaras on that daf, if you were learning the daf yesterday, is, you know, El Darsheni, there's something that needs to be explained about what's going on there, because it would seem that even without a obligation of Kibbut Abayim, there should be more Hakar Satov, you would expect. But the Chasam Sofer quotes this Gemara to say that you see that there isn't an obligation of Kibbut Abayim that comes along with adoption, and that's apparently his message. So others thought that that doesn't sound like that's the case, and that there are other sources in Chazal that seem to be explicitly addressing this. So, for example, the Medrash says that when God told Moshe to go back to Paro after he was already with Yisro, that Moshe said, I have to take Rishus first from Yisro, because here Yisro opened his house to me and took me in, and I certainly have to have Hakar Satov to him and to have respect to him. And there the comment is, again, that this is a Kilu Yolad, or even better, perhaps, than a parent. So there are many sources that indicate that there is an obligation like that towards an adoptive parent. There's room, maybe, for a Chakira, whether it's just because of Hakar Satov, meaning it contains the same active ingredient, but it's a different mitzvah, or that makes it the actual mitzvah of Kibbut Abayim, and maybe the room there to be Mesupik is, even if we assume that it's about Hakar Satov, but what's that Hakar Satov for? It's Hakar Satov for bringing you into the world, so giving you your whole existence to begin with, or for everything that happens after that. So a parent who adopts a child presumably should be credited with all of that. So there's a tshuva also in a contemporary sefer called Mizrach Shemesh, which was written by a Rav from Hong Kong, in the Tanul Ma'odeid. And he also points to many makaros that certainly indicate that there would be an obligation of some kind of Hakar Satov / Kibud to a adoptive parent. And the question is, so what to do with yesterday's daf, which sounds so surprising. So he has two approaches there. One approach is that maybe he didn't actually adopt him. He was involved with him a little bit, and it's not necessarily comparable to an adoptive parent who really fully absorbs all of the needs of this child. But another answer that he has there, which isn't really reflective of the text, but who knows, maybe it's there in the background, and that could yield some interesting perspectives also, is that maybe he was already attending to a biological parent, and that this here, again, the double score of being also the grandfather, which you assume should also be dukavod, is maybe trying to get his attention at the same time as when he was dealing with an actual parent. And maybe that's why he got that response. So that's an interesting point to consider also, because there is a drasha in Chazal and Parshat Vayigash, and the pasuk says that Yaakov, when he went down to Mitzrayim on the way, he offered karbonos v'yizbach zvachim le'elokei aviv Yitzchak, that he offered karbonos in honor of the God of his father Yitzchak. So why not his grandfather Avram, who certainly deserves that association as much. So it says there that mikan she'chayiv adam v'chvayir aviv yosher mi'aviv aviv, that he's obligated in the covet of a father even more than a grandfather. So the Marik, the Ramo quotes Marik, is saying, if I remember correctly, there's no obligation of kibud for a grandparent. And he and others note that that's not the implication of Medrash, not that there's no chiyuv of kibud for grandparent, but that it's not as much as for the parent. And that's itself still a question, because you might think that really there should be a greater obligation towards the grandparent, that it all accumulates. And in the same vein as the Gemara that talks about if a father and a mother who are still married ask the child at the same time for service, so there the Gemara says that the priority goes to the father because both he and his mother are obligated and covered to the father, so therefore it all accumulates. So you would think that'd be true by a grandparent also. So there is a truth about this in the Minchas Elazar, and what emerges from there is that you might be right mathematically that really there should be an even greater chiyuv of kavod the farther back you go, and it's a chiddush. That's the whole point. It's a chiddush in the pasuk to say that nonetheless we have to prioritize the father because the family structure needs to maintain a certain kind of framework in order for it to function. So that means that the father is the head of the hierarchy, and that's why the Gemara says that davka when the parents are married, so then the mother has a obligation of kavod to him that's going to affect the priorities. But that wouldn't be true if they were divorced, the Gemara says. So it seems to be that there is a need for the family to function in a certain way that is superimposed on top of other considerations that may have yielded other conclusions in terms of kavod. So maybe that's what's going on there also in terms of yesterday's daf, that yes, there is an obligation of kavod to certainly somebody who's both roles, a grandfather and a adoptive parent, but maybe it was in conflict with something else and maybe that was the message. It's hard to know. It's a very difficult Gemara otherwise. So that's in terms of that. There are other suggestions also among the Rishonim and the Mefarshim why it is that Moshe is credited with this. The Kli Yakar and the Arachayim discussed that also that after the Chet HaEgel, so Hashem was going to kill all the sons of Aaron. Aaron was involved in this problematic way in the Chet HaEgel, and that was going to be the consequence, and Moshe davened for them, and he was able to do a partial Hatzalah, so these two, they were saved. So therefore, they're also credited to him because he literally kept them in the world. Maybe he didn't bring them in the world, but he kept them in the world through his tefillah. So maybe that's why. Many note that there's also the other side of the equation here, that Moshe is credited for Aaron's sons. But what about Moshe's own children? So we don't see them actually named. So the Pasuk is saying, these are the toldos of Moshe and Aaron. So there's two questions. So why is Moshe being credited for Aaron's sons, and why, if we're listing the toldos of Moshe, so why are his biological children not listed? So it's something many Mefarshim talk about. Rav Hirsch suggests that Moshe's sons are not named here because we're not naming all the descendants, we're only naming those who have public positions, and Moshe didn't put his sons in public positions, so he didn't assume that they were necessarily worthy just because they were his sons. And that's itself significant, and that's itself noteworthy. And that point about when these things pass from one generation to the next is an interesting question, which we'll revisit in a second, looking at this next pasuk. So pasuk Dalet, so skip a little bit. So after we list the names here, Rav Hirsch notes that there's a somewhat awkward trop in Pasuk Beis. It says, Asnachta Adur Nadav, and then it goes back to Avihu, Elazar V'Yisomar. It seems that it's, you know, kind of lingering tragically over those names of the two that aren't alive anymore, and then to skip to the other two who are. So that's an interesting observation of itself. But that fact that they died is mentioned in Pasuk Dalet, V'yamas Nadav V'Avihu L'fnei Hashem, V'hakriva Meish Zorah L'fnei Hashem V'mivar Sinai, U'vanim L'hayu Lahem. So about that, about their death, so Hirsch has a comment about that also, about the reason it's mentioned, that it happened, and it's mentioned here, is because it's highlighting that really what they did was essentially the opposite of the kahuna, that Esh Zara, that's referred to here, it means that they introduced arbitrariness into the service, that they brought in the idea that they could do what they think is right. And that's really the opposite of the kahuna, because the kahuna is about service, it's about submission. So what they were doing was such a clash to the whole notion of kahuna. So that maybe is the problem, but also why it's mentioned here as we talk about these things, how that was a problem, that was what went wrong with them. So the pasuk continues, Vayechayin Elazar v'Yisomer al pnei Aaron avihem. So here, the other remaining sons Elazar and Isamar, so they served in the Kahuna. Al Pnei Aaron Aviyam. So what does that mean, Al Pnei Aaron Aviyam? So Rashi comments, B'chayev, that they served even when he was alive. And the Ramban suggests, no, it's not what it's talking about. That he argues on Rashi, it says that they were anointed as Kohanim Gedolim. And they would only do that after Aaron was no longer alive. But they were anointed now, and given that status at this time. So there is a discussion, the Sefer of Discussions of Torah, of Chalach Discussions of Torah, called Midei Shabbos. So he has a discussion there about the whole notion of Yerusha by Srara. Can a public position pass on to the next generation as a kind of Yerusha? This is a major issue nowadays, I think, in our culture. We don't see that so much. It's not really such a element of Jewish public life, but once upon a time it was quite a discussion. So it comes up in discussions about the Rabbanis. Do we say that a child of, do we say that a son of a previous rabbi has kedimus to be the Rav? Do we say that a son-in-law has kedimus over others, or how does that relate to the son? So is there a notion of Yerusha there? The Abinezer had a notable tshuva about this, a very long tshuva, where that's entitled Sheish Ma'alos Tefisei, where he discussed these issues. So here, the idea that apparently they are given this status, even when the father's alive, so apparently the Yerusha applies even the Chayav, which is unusual, that's normally not the case when it comes to Yerusha, and yet we do see this in other places. So the discussion in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, that when you have a Chazin, so a Chazin theoretically might be able to pass on his position to his son, and it seems like while he's still alive also. Mishnah Berurah over there has a comment. This is in Aruch Chaim Simon Gimel Sif Chavei, and the Mishnah Berurah has a comment about whether this would apply to Talmud Torah also, and big sad to say no, because we say Torah is not a Yerusha, but the idea that any position like this could be a Yerusha, and specifically even when the father is still alive, is interesting and surprising, and especially because it's not his bialos anyway that he could give this to others, that he should be able to pass it on to his own son, if it's not in your control. So why is it something that should even go be Yerusha at all? So he suggests there that this is reflective of the fact that this is a different kind of concept. You may call it Yerusha, but it's not really Yerusha in the normal sense, where Yerusha is about physical property that transfers specifically only after the death of the parent. And during the parent's lifetime, they could give it to anyone. So this is a different concept. This is a notion of kam tachtav, that the son occupies the position of the father, and therefore, yes, it could apply even when the father's there. If the father's moved on to another position, he's still alive, so the son could occupy it as one hemshech, and it's not the same thing as Yerusha. It's interesting, the relationship that it may or may not have to Yerusha, because there are some of the Mefarshim suggest that the whole concept of how Yerusha works is maybe something similar, but maybe it also depends what kind of Yerusha we're talking about. So some understand that specifically the Yerusha of the Bechor is like that, that the special stature that's given to the firstborn is a reflection of the fact that he specifically is kam tachtav, that he specifically comes to fulfill the status and to occupy the position of the father. So maybe that's what's going on here. Okay, so I just want to mention one other topic that's here, and also that's earlier in the parsha as well, and that's the mitzvah of Shmiras HaMikdash. So there is an obligation to have guards by the Mikdash from the Levim, and the way it's brought in a number of the Moni HaMitzvot and Rishonim, the way the Rambam brings it in Hilchot Beis HaBechira and Parachas HaLach Aleph, and in the Sefer HaMitzvot and Hilchot Beis, is that this is a mitzvah saseh, and that it applies even if we're not afraid of anyone invading, even if we don't think anyone's going to come in, that this is a kavod. So this is an honor guard, essentially. And that's why we have these posted here. And this is also what it sounds like from the Sefer HaChinuch, and also the Ramban over there, that they're there to display kavod to the Mishkan, to the Beis HaMikdash. So this is a concept that the world is familiar with from the guards at Buckingham Palace. So this week, the aftermath of the coronation, when a lot of the world was focused on the grandeur of the Malucha, so a part of that is honor guards, guards who are there who are not necessarily accomplishing so much as far as being intimidating, as far as protection, but it's even more of a display than it is a actual protection, because that's the idea. It's a reflection of kavod rather than serving a traditional guard role. Rav Asher Weiss has an essay about this in his Sefer Menachos Asher on Bava Midbar, and he suggests that that's also why the Rambam has this in Hilchos Beis Bechira and not in Klei HaMikdash, because this is not an avoda. This is a part of the setup of the Beis HaMikdash. So therefore, it's a part of the construction, so to speak, that there should be a binyan, and that there should be guards who are there as a part of the background. But at the same time, as much as all these Rishonim do say that, as Rav Asher notes in that essay, but it does still seem that they are there to keep people from going in who shouldn't be there. So there is somewhat of a tension there, that some of the psukim sound like that. The psukim sound like they're there for that purpose. In fact, the Rambam Mar Nebuchim sounds like that. But on the other hand, there are details that go back to sounding like it's just about honor. So, for example, the post seems the guards. Where are the guards? The guards are by the gates, but they're also by the corners. So if it was about preventing entry, so you would think they wouldn't need to be by the corners, and they'd just be by the gates. It also seems that, at least according to the Rambam and maybe others, that it only applies at night. You only have the Shemira at night when the doors were locked anyway. So that also seems to indicate that it's not necessarily about protection in the traditional sense. Now, that question of, is it only at night? There may be somewhat of a debate about this. The Mefarish, the fake Rashi of Maseches Tamid, assumed that it does apply all day, that guards there all day. It could be that Rashi maybe agreed with that as well. The Menachos Chinuch has a discussion about this where he asks where the Rambam is coming from, that he thinks that makes more sense, that there should be guards all day. So if the Rambam is assuming the guards only there at night, so where does he get that from? So Rav Asher suggests that maybe this could be explained by a comment of the Rush to Maseches Tamid, that the Rush understands that the purpose of these guards is that there shouldn't be a Hesach Hadas from the Mishkan. We should always be paying attention to it. So maybe during the day we have the Avoda, so we don't need that. There's stuff going on. But during overnight, when we don't have that going on, so then there's a need for the guards in order to serve that purpose, there shouldn't be a Hesach Hadas. Rav Asher also suggests that maybe you have here two laws, maybe there's two dinim, maybe there's two aspects here, that there is an aspect of kavod and there's also a functional aspect. And he suggests that maybe that idea of a second component could explain its placement of this topic in Parshas Korach. So we have it here and we have it also in Parshas Korach. So maybe here it's actually more protective, as the psukim maybe sound like. And in the context of Parshas Korach, there was an additional level that was instituted that was more of a display. And maybe the point was, he suggests, in order to forestall any further kinds of rebellion like Korach, that Korach rebelled against the concept of the Leviyah and the Kahuna. And therefore, we want to emphasize that we believe in these institutions. So to show this extra covet to the Mikdash with the Levian, maybe that's a part of the response to Korach, and maybe that's where you have that extra notion. Many of the Rishonim, it sounds like that you could have even children doing this job. They don't have to be Gedolim necessarily, but even Ketanim could be fulfilling the role of Shmiras HaMikdash. And the Mishnah Malach asks why that is, if it's a mitzvah, so it should be limited to those who are high in mitzvahs. So he suggests that maybe it is that there's a rule here that the din is not a din in the one watching, but the din is in the mikdash, that the mikdash should be watched, so it should be guarded. So therefore, you don't have to be high in mitzvahs in order to serve this role, as long as you're able to watch it. The Avin Lezer has a tshuva where he considers that possibility, and he draws a comparison to Achilas Kadshim, which could involve Ketanim also, but then he personally thinks maybe that's not perfect, because maybe there, Shekein Nene, since eating is considered to be automatic in terms of Chiyuvim and the like, and maybe Kavan also, so then maybe that's why, even if eating Kadshim is a din in the Kadshim, still it could be done by Ketanim, but who knows if that's also true when it comes to Shmira. So Rav Asher suggests that he doesn't see why it should matter that there's a special aspect of Nene that would apply to Kadshim. He thinks it makes sense that it should apply here as well. And that it sounds like from the Avnei Nezer that even if they don't have to actually be Gedolim, but they do have to be old enough to know what they're doing. They have to be able to be conscious of the nature, that even if we say that this is primarily there for Kavod, but still what's happening for Kavod is that there's a guard there. So the guard has to have a concept of guarding, so presumably that's still a requirement. Right.
Are that measure going to non-Jew do shir
smicha? That's an interesting question. So maybe theoretically the question is that going to be a covet or not? So, and how much is it connected? So that's an interesting issue to bring up. The Menachas Chinuch suggests, it seems a little differently, they says even a cherish or a shota could fulfill this din. So maybe it's not about actual protection. Maybe it is just about the symbolism. So these are somewhat open questions, which don't seem to be negaya right now. It's a little hechus l'mashicha, but the Avin Ezer does bring up the question, which Rav Asher Weiss discusses also in his sefer, that maybe we should say that this should apply nowadays also. That maybe there should be guards on the Har Habayis, even if there's no Beis Hamikdash. And the Avin Ezer discusses that maybe that should depend on, even if we say it's about protection in the active sense, but what is being protected? So if it's the kelim of the mikdash, so in the Hanami there aren't any. But if the idea is you're supposed to protect it from people who aren't supposed to be there, so then maybe theoretically there could be a place for that. But just to go back for a moment and to focus on what we saw from the Rush and others, that this, in addition to being a concept that is not so practically oriented as much as it is a statement, as much as it is a reflection of kavod, rather than the practicalities of it. So to put that together with the Rush's idea of not being a hesach hadas, so that aspect, one would think, is particularly relevant of Bizman Hazeh. And we are nearing the end of Sfirah Sa'omer, and Sfirah Sa'omer, there's a machlokes whether we're actually chayiv in the Torah and Sfiras Omer nowadays. It's clearly a mitzvah that originates in the Torah and Parshas Emor, but whether or not it's actually in play when the Korban Omer is not brought, that was a machlokes. Many Rishonim thought not, but we do know that we are still counting Sfira every day. So if we're assuming that it was tied in to the Hakrovas HaOmer, and so it shouldn't apply, so it means that what we're doing is instead Zeich HaMikdash, we count the Omer because we have to maintain a focus on the Beis HaMikdash, and maybe even all the more so when it's not here. So this notion of Shmira being connected to preventing Hesach Hadas, and the question of whether it applies Bizman Hazeh, so that seems to perhaps have an additional level of application, especially Bizman Hazeh, and maybe that's a part of what our practice of Sfiras Omer is meant to accomplish. And that has an extra level of synergy for us right now, because we are almost at the bridge between the Yom Yerushalayim as observed in Eretz Yisrael and the Yom Yerushalayim on the calendar, which is tomorrow. So either today or tomorrow is Yom Yerushalayim, or both. So we're at the point between them. And the notion of Yom Yerushalayim, which commemorates really pretty much a Nes Nigla that happened and that restored the Beis HaMikdash to the Jewish people. So this idea that there's a little synergy here, that our parsha is telling us that there's a mitzvah to guard the Mikdash. So first of all, the idea that literally the guards of the Jewish people were able to reconnect with the Beis HaMikdash on this date is something to note and something to have tremendous hakar satov for. It's very hard for all of us in this room who were born after that time to appreciate just how inconceivable it was before then that Yerushalayim would be returned to the Jewish people in such a way that before that, it's very close to that time, people believed that it was just something we had to wait for Mashiach, and it was not going to be a possibility any time before that. And now, all of us have been born into a world where it's the case, where we take it for granted. So to appreciate just what that means, and to take note of this date on the calendar of Yom Yerushalayim, and to recognize that that is also perhaps the kiyum in the mitzvah of this parsha, of not being Mesiach Das from Yerushalayim, not being Mesiach Das from the Beis HaMikdash, that was the area that was recovered in Yom Yerushalayim, and that our continuing connection, our continuing mental and spiritual connection, is what ultimately allows for us to return. And Yerushalayim has a dual role in for the Jewish people. Rav Shachter Shlita has an essay about this in Bikvei Atzon, that it is both the Kiryas Melech Rav, it is the capital city of the great king, it is the political capital of the nation of God, and it is also the Ir HaKodesh Ramikdash, it is the holiest place within Jewish tradition. And the idea that there can be a nation that combines those two functions in one location, the political center of its culture, together with the holiest place, and understands the need for those to be harmonized and for those to reflect one unified goal and one unified vision, is a very powerful thought. And our parsha reminds us that we are obligated to protect that idea, to protect it literally, to protect it as a concept, to protect it as something that we think about and that we're not Mesiach Das about. So to take this opportunity of Yom Yerushalayim to certainly have Hakar Satov, as we started this aliyah talking about the notion of Hakar Satov and the Mechaivim that come from that, and many who understand that Kibud Av V'Em is about Hakar Satov, is also there as a kli for us to be able to be makir tov to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we owe HaKadosh Baruch Hu everything, but we're not able to relate always, and therefore we have an easier time relating to his human partners, and therefore the kavod that is shown to parents is a reflection of the HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we owe to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And as the Mefarshim explained, that if we can't have HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the human beings who have done the most for us, so that it seems like we're not connected to Hakar Satov at all, and then the whole religion falls away, the whole notion of being able to relate to Hakadosh Baruch Hu when the Torah falls away. So this is a time to have Hakar Satov for a really spectacular miracle that people who were alive then thought was an impossibility. And we have the big schus of being able to relate to an impossibility as a reality, and that is something to be makir tov for sure. And also through that Hakar Satov, to fulfill this goal of not allowing there to be a Hasach Hadas, and protecting the memory and the reality and the potential of the Kiryas Melech Rav and the Ir HaKodesh V'Hamikdash within our hearts. And through that, the Kedi Hiratzon, that we should see a full Geula Shleima, and that we should be able to fulfill that type of a connection in every sense of the word. So I wish you all a wonderful Shabbos, and a holy Yom Yerushalayim, and Shabbat Shalom.